Tell her to come over if she wants. Tell her what's happened. It's going to completely suck if you have to leave right now. Zandra had grown sufficiently distracted with guests and grief that Boris was able to go upstairs to make the call in her bedroom, a room usually kept locked that Boris and I never saw. In about 10 minutes, he came skimming rapidly down the steps.
Kotku said to stay, he said, ducking in to sit beside me. She told me to say she's sorry.
Wow, I said, coming close to tears, scrubbing my hand over my face so he wouldn't see how startled and touched I was.
Well, I mean, she knows how it is. Her dad died too.
Oh yeah?
Yes, a few years ago, in a motor accident as well. They weren't that close.
Who died?
Said Janet, swaying over us, a frizzy, silk-bloused presence redolent of weed and beauty products.
Somebody else died?
No,
I said curtly. I didn't like Janet. She was the ditz who'd volunteered to take care of Popper and then left him locked up alone with his food dispenser.
Not you. Him,
she said, stepping backwards and focusing her foggy attention on Boris.
Somebody died? That you were close to?
Several people, yeah.
She blinked.
Where are you from?
Why?
Your voice is so funny. Like British or something. Well, no, like a mix of British and Transylvania.
Boris hooted.
Transylvania, he said, showing her his fangs. Do you want me to bite you?
Oh, funny boys,
she said vaguely, before bopping Boris on the top of the head with the bottom of her wine glass and wandering off to say goodbye to Stuart and Lisa, who were just leaving. Zandra, it seemed, had taken a pill.
Maybe more than one, said Boris in my ear.
She appeared on the verge of passing out. Boris, it was shitty of me, but I just wasn't willing to do it, took her cigarette away from her and stubbed it out, then helped Courtney get her up the stairs and into her room, where she lay face down on the bedspread with the door open. I stood in the doorway while Boris and Courtney got her shoes off, interested to see, for once, the room that she and my dad always kept locked up. Dirty cups and ashtrays, stacks of Glamour magazine, puffy green bedspread, laptop I never got to use, exercise bike. Who knew they had an exercise bike in there? Zandra's shoes were off, but they decided to leave her dressed.
Do you want me to spend the night?
Courtney was asking Boris in a low voice. Boris shamelessly stretched and yawned. His shirt was riding up and his jeans hung so low you could see he wasn't wearing any underwear.
Nice of you, he said. But she is out cold, I think.
I don't mind.
Maybe I was high. I was high, but she was leaning so close to him it looked like she was trying to make out with him or something, which was hilarious. I must have made some sort of semi-choking or laughter-like noise, since Courtney turned just in time to see my comical gesture to Boris, a thumb jerked at the door.
Get her out of here.
Are you okay?
She said coldly, eyeing me up and down. Boris was laughing too, but he'd straightened up by the time she turned back to him, his expression all soulful and concerned, which only made me laugh harder. 19. Zandra was out cold by the time they all left, asleep so deeply that Boris got a pocket mirror from her purse, which we had rifled for pills and cash, and held it under her nose to see if she was breathing. There was $229 in her wallet, which I didn't feel all that bad about taking, since she still had her credit cards and an uncashed check for $2,025.
I knew Zandra wasn't her real name, I said, tossing him her driver's license.
Orange-tinged face, different fluffed-up hair, name Sandra J. Terrell, no restrictions.
Wonder what these keys go to.
Boris, like an old-fashioned movie doctor, fingers on her pulse, sitting by her on the side of the bed, held the mirror up to the light.
Da, da,
he muttered. Then something else I didn't understand.
Huh? She's gone.
With one finger, he prodded her shoulder and then leaned over and peered into the nightstand drawer, where I was rapidly sorting through a bewilderment of junk.
change, chips, lip gloss, coasters, false eyelashes, nail polish remover, tattered paperbacks, your erroneous zones, perfume samples, old cassette tapes, 10 years expired insurance cards, and a bunch of giveaway matchbooks from a Reno legal office that said, representing DWI and all drug offenses.
Hey, let me have those,
said Boris, reaching over and pocketing a strip of condoms.
What's this?
He picked up something that at first glance looked like a Coke can, but when he shook it, it rattled. He put his ear to it.
Ha!
He said, tossing it to me.
Good job.
I screwed off the top. It was obviously fake, and dumped the contents out on the top of the nightstand.
Wow,
I said, after a few moments. Clearly this was where Zandra kept her tip money. Partly cash, partly chips. There was a lot of other stuff, too. So much I had a hard time taking it all in. But my eyes had gone straight to the diamond and emerald earrings that my mother had found missing right before my father took off.
Wow,
I said again, picking up one of them between thumb and forefinger. My mother had worn these earrings for almost every cocktail party or dress-up occasion. The blue-green transparency of the stones, their wicked 3 a.m. gleam, were as much a part of her as the color of her eyes or the spicy, dark smell of her hair. Boris was cackling. Amidst the cash, he'd immediately spotted and snatched up a film canister, which he opened with trembling hands. He dipped the end of his little finger in, tasted it.
Bingo, he said, running the finger along his gums. Kotku's going to be pissed she didn't come over now.
I held out the earrings to him on my open hands.
Yeah, nice,
he said, hardly looking at them. He was tapping out a pile of powder on the nightstand.
You'll get a couple of $1,000 for those.
These were my mother's. My dad had sold most of her jewelry back in New York, including her wedding ring. But now, I saw, Zandra had skimmed some of it for herself, and it made me weirdly sad to see what she'd chosen. Not the pearls or the ruby brooch, but inexpensive things from my mother's teenage days, including her junior high charm bracelet, a jingle with horseshoes and ballet slippers and four-leaf clovers. Boris straightened up, pinched his nostrils, handed me the rolled-up bill.
You want some?
No.
Come on. It'll make you feel better.
No, thanks.
There must be 4 or 5 8-balls here. Maybe more. We can keep one and sell the others.
You did that stuff before? I said doubtfully, eyeing Zandra's prone body. Even though she was clearly down for the count, I didn't like having these conversations over her back.
Yeah, Kotku likes it. Expensive, though.
He seemed to blank out for a minute, then blinked his eyes rapidly.
Wow, come on, he said, laughing. Here, don't know what you're missing.
I'm too fucked up as it is, I said, shuffling through the money.
Yeah, but this will sober you up.
Boris, I can't goof around, I said, pocketing the earrings and the charm bracelet.
If we're going, we need to leave now, before people start showing up.
What people? Said Boris skeptically, running his finger back and forth under his nose.
Believe me, it happens fast.
Child services coming in and like that. I'd counted the cash. $1,321 plus change. There was much more in chips, close to $5,000 worth, but might as well leave her those.
Half for you and half for me,
I said, as I began to count the cash into 2 even piles.
There's enough here for 2 tickets. Probably we're too late to catch the last flight, but we should go ahead and take a car to the airport.
Now? Tonight? I stopped counting and looked at him.
I don't have anyone out here. Nobody. Nada. They'll stick me in a home so fast I won't know what hit me.
Boris nodded at Zandra's body, which was very unnerving as in her face-down mattress splay, she looked way too much like a dead person.
What about her? What the fuck?
I said after a brief pause.
What should we do? Wait around until she wakes up and finds out we ripped her off?
Dunno, said Boris, eyeing her doubtfully. I just feel bad for her.
Well, don't. She doesn't want me. She'll call them herself as soon as she realizes she's stuck with me.
Them? I don't understand. Who is this them?
Boris, I'm a minor. I could feel my panic rising in an all-too-familiar way. Maybe the situation wasn't literally life or death, but it sure felt like it. House filling with smoke, exits closing off. I don't know how it works in your country, but I don't have any family. No friends out here.
Me? You have me? What are you going to do? Adopt me?
I stood up. Look, if you're coming, we need to hurry. Do you have your passport? You'll need it for the plane. Boris put his hands up in his Russianate enough already gesture.
Wait, this is happening way too fast.
I stopped, halfway out the door.
What the fuck is your problem, Boris?
My problem?
You wanted to run away. It was you who asked me to go with you last night.
Where are you going?
New York?
Where else? I want to go someplace warm, he said instantly. California.
That's crazy. Who do we know?
California!
He crowed. Well, though I knew almost nothing about California, it was safe to assume that, apart from the bar of California Uber Alles he was humming, Boris knew even less.
Where in California? What town?
Who cares? It's a big state.
Fantastic. It'll be fun. We'll stay high all the time, read books, build campfires, sleep on the beach.
I looked at him for a long, unbearable moment. His face was on fire and his mouth was stained blackish from the red wine.
All right, I said,
knowing full well I was stepping off the edge and into the major mistake of my life. Petty theft, the change cup, sidewalk nods and homelessness, the fuck-up from which I would never recover. He was gleeful.
The beach, then? Yes?
This was how you went wrong. This fast. Wherever you want, I said, pushing the hair out of my eyes. I was dead exhausted.
But we need to go now. Please.
What, this minute?
Yes. Do you need to go home and get anything?
Tonight?
I'm not kidding, Boris.
Arguing with him was making the panic rise again.
I can't just sit around and wait.
The painting was a problem. I wasn't sure how that was going to work, but once I got Boris out of the house, I could figure something out.
Please, come on.
Is state care that bad in America?
Said Boris doubtfully.
You make it seem like the cops.
Are you coming with me? Yes or no?
I need some time. I mean, he said, following after me, we can't leave now.
Really, I swear.
Wait a little while. Give me a day.
One day.
Why?
He seemed nonplussed.
Well, I mean, because...
Because?
Because I have to see Kotku. And all kinds of things.
Honest, you can't leave tonight,
he repeated, when I said nothing.
Trust me. You'll be sorry, I mean it. Come to my house. Wait till the morning to go.
I can't wait, I said curtly, taking my half of the cash and heading back to my room.
Potter,
he followed after me.
Yes? There is something important I have to tell you.
Boris, I said, turning.
What the motherfuck? What is it?
I said, as we stood and stared at each other.
If you have something to say, go on and say it.
I am afraid it will make you mad.
What is it? What have you done?
Boris was silent, gnawing the side of his thumb.
Well, what?
He looked away.
You need to stay, he said vaguely. You're making a mistake.
Forget it, I snapped, turning away again. If you don't want to come with me, don't come, okay?
But I can't stand around here all night.
Boris, I thought, might ask what was in the pillowcase, particularly since it was so fat and weirdly shaped after my over-enthusiastic wrapping job. But when I untaped it from the back of the headboard and put it in my overnight bag, along with my iPod, notebook, charger, wind, sand, and stars, some pictures of my mom,
my toothbrush, and a change of clothes. He only scowled and said nothing. When I retrieved, from the back of my closet, my school blazer, too small for me, though it had been too big when my mother bought it. He nodded and said, "Good idea, that." "What?"
"Makes you look less homeless."
"It's November," I said. I'd only brought one warm sweater from New York. I put it in the bag and zipped it up. "It's going to be cold." Boris leaned insolently against the wall.
"What will you do then? Live on the street? Railway station? Where?"
"I'll call my friend I stayed with before."
"If they wanted you, those people, they'd have adopted you already."
"They couldn't. How could they?" Boris folded his arms.
"They didn't want you, that family. You told me so yourself lots of times. Also, you never hear from them."
"That's not true," I said, after a brief, confused pause. Only a few months before, Andy had sent me a longish, for him, email telling me about some stuff going on at school, a scandal with the tennis coach feeling up girls in our class, though that life was so far away that it was like reading about people I didn't know.
"Too many children?" said Boris, a bit smugly, as it seemed. "Not enough room? Remember that bit? You said the mother and father were glad to see you go."
"Fuck off." I was already getting a huge headache. What would I do if social services showed up and put me in the back of a car? Who, in Nevada, could I call? Mrs. Spear? The playa? The fat model store clerk who sold us model glue without the models? Boris followed me downstairs, where we were stopped in the middle of the living room by a tortured-looking pauper, who ran directly into our path, then stopped and stared at us like he knew exactly what was going on. "Oh, fuck," I said, putting down my bag. There was silence. "Boris," I said, "can't you, no, can't Kotku, no." "Well, fuck it," I said, picking him up and tucking him under my arm. "I'm not leaving him here for her to lock up and starve."
"And where are you going?"
said Boris as I started for the front door.
"Huh? Walking? To the airport?"
"Wait," I said, putting Popchick down. All at once I felt sick and like I might vomit red wine all over the carpet. "Will they take a dog on the plane?"
"No,"
said Boris ruthlessly, spitting out a chewed thumbnail. He was being an asshole. I wanted to punch him. "Okay, then," I said. "Maybe somebody at the airport will want him. Or fuck it, I'll take the train." He was about to say something sarcastic, lips pursed in a way I knew well, but then, quite suddenly, his expression faltered, and I turned to see Zandra, wild-eyed, mascara smeared, swaying on the landing at the top of the stairs. We looked at her, frozen. After what seemed like a centuries-long pause, she opened her mouth, closed it again, caught the railing to balance herself, and then said, in a rusty voice,
"Did Larry leave his keys in the bank vault?"
We looked at her, frozen, for several more moments before we realized she was waiting for a reply. Her hair was like a haystack. She seemed completely disoriented, and so unsteady, it seemed she might topple down the steps.
Yes, said Boris loudly. "I mean, no."
And then, when she still stood there,
"It's all right. Go back to bed."
She mumbled something and, uncertain on her feet, staggered off. The two of us stood motionless for some moments. Then, quietly, the back of my neck prickling, I got my bag and slipped out the front door. My last sight of that house, and her, though I didn't even take a last look around. And Boris and Popchick came out after me. Together, all three of us walked rapidly away from the house and down to the end of the street, Popchick's toenails clicking on the pavement.
"All right," said Boris, in the humorous undertone he used when we had a close call at the supermarket. "Okay, maybe not quite so much out cold as I thought."
I was in a cold sweat, and the night air, though chilly, felt good. Off in the west, silent Frankenstein flashes of lightning twisted in the darkness.
"Well, at least she's not dead, eh?"
he chuckled.
I was worried about her. Christ.
Let me use your phone, I said, elbowing on my jacket. I need to call a car. He fished in his pocket and handed it to me. It was a disposable phone, the one he'd bought to keep tabs on Kotku.
No, keep it, he said, holding his hands up.
When I tried to give it back to him after I'd made my call. Lucky cab. 777-7777. The number plastered on every shifty-looking bus stop bench in Vegas. Then he dug out the wad of money, his half of the take from Xandra, and tried to press it on me.
Forget it,
I said, glancing back anxiously at the house. I was afraid she might wake up again and come out in the street looking for us.
It's yours.
No, you might need it.
I don't want it,
I said, sticking my hands in my pockets to keep him from foisting it on me.
Anyway, you might need it yourself.
Come on, Potter. I wish you wouldn't go this moment.
He gestured down the street at the rows of empty houses.
If you won't come to my house, keep over there for a day or two. That brick house has furniture in it, even. I'll bring you food if you want.
Or, hey, I can call Domino's,
I said, sticking the phone in my jacket pocket.
Since they deliver out here now and everything.
He winced.
Don't be angry.
I'm not. And in truth, I wasn't. Only so disoriented I felt I might wake up and find I'd been sleeping with a book over my face. Boris, I realized, was looking up at the sky and humming to himself. A line from one of my mother's Velvet Underground songs. But if you close the door, the night could last forever.
What about you?
I said, rubbing my eyes.
Eh?
He said, looking at me with a smile. What's up? Will I see you again?
Maybe,
he said, in the same cheerful tone I imagined him using with Bammy and Judy, the barkeep's wife, and Carmi Wallag, and everyone else in his life he'd ever said goodbye to.
Who knows? Will you meet me in a day or two?
Well,
join me later. Take a plane. You have the money. I'll call you and tell you where I am. Don't say no.
Okay, then,
said Boris in the same cheerful voice.
I won't say no.
But clearly, from his tone, he was saying no. I closed my eyes.
Oh, God.
I was so tired, I was reeling. I had to fight the urge to lie down on the ground, a physical undertow pulling me to the curb. When I opened my eyes, I saw Boris looking at me with concern.
Look at you,
he said,
falling over almost.
He reached in his pocket. No, 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 I said, stepping back, when I saw what he had in his hand.
No way, forget it. It'll make you feel better.
That's what you said about the other stuff.
I wasn't up for any more seaweed or singing stars.
Really, I don't want any. But this is different. Completely different. It will sober you up. Clear your head. Promise.
Right. A drug that sobered you up and cleared your head didn't sound like Boris's style at all, although he did seem a good bit more with it than me.
Look at me,
he said reasonably.
Yes.
He knew he had me.
Am I raving? Frothing at the mouth? No. Only being helpful. Here,
he said, tapping some out on the back of his hand.
Come on, let me feed it to you.
I half expected it was a trick, that I would pass out on the spot and wake up who knew where, maybe in one of the empty houses across the street. But I was too tired to care, and maybe that would have been okay anyway. I leaned forward and allowed him to press one nostril closed with a fingertip.
There,
he said encouragingly.
Like this. Now, sniff.
Almost instantly, I did feel better. It was like a miracle.
Wow,
I said, pinching my nose against the sharp, pleasant sting.
Didn't I tell you?
He was already tapping out some more.
Here, other nose. Don't breathe out. Okay, now.
Everything seemed brighter and clearer, including Boris himself.
What did I tell you?
He was taking more for himself now.
Aren't you sorry you don't listen?
You're going to sell this stuff.
God, I said, looking up at the sky.
Why?
It's worth a lot, actually. Few thousands of dollars.
That little bit?
Not that little. This is a lot of grams. 20, maybe more. Could make a fortune if I divide up small and sell to girls like Katie Behrman.
You know Katie Behrman? Katie Behrman, who was a year ahead of us, had her own car, a black convertible, and was so far out of our social scale she might as well have been a movie star.
Sure, Sky, Katie, Jessica, all those girls. Anyway,
he offered me the vial again.
I can buy Kotku that keyboard she wants now. No more money worries.
We went back and forth a few times until I began to feel much more optimistic about the future and things in general. And as we stood rubbing our noses and jabbering in the street, Popper looking up at us curiously, the wonderfulness of New York seemed right on the tip of my tongue, an evanescence possible to convey.
I mean, it's great, I said.
The words were spiraling and tumbling out of me.
Really, you have to come. We can go to Brighton Beach. That's where all the Russians hang out.
Well, I've never been there. But the train goes there. It's the last stop on the line.
There's a big Russian community. Restaurants with smoked fish and sturgeon roe.
My mother and I always talked about going out there to eat one day. This jeweler she worked with told her the good places to go. But we never did. It's supposed to be great. Also, I mean, I have money for school.
You can go to my school.
No, you totally can. I have a scholarship.
Well, I did.
But the guy said as long as the money in my fund was used for education,
it could be anybody's education.
Not just mine. There's more than enough for both of us. Though, I mean, public school. The public schools are good in New York. I know people there. Public school's fine with me. I was still babbling when Boris said,
Potter.
Before I could answer him, he put both hands on my face and kissed me on the mouth. And while I stood blinking, it was over almost before I knew what had happened. He picked up Popper under the forearms and kissed him, too, in midair, smack on the tip of his nose. Then he handed him to me.
Your car's over there, he said,
giving him one last ruffle on the head. And, sure enough, when I turned, a town car was creeping up the other side of the street, surveying the addresses. We stood looking at each other, me breathing hard, completely stunned.
Good luck, said Boris. I won't forget you.
Then he patted Popper on the head.
Bye, Popchik. Look after him, will you?
He said to me. Later, in the cab and afterward, I would replay that moment and marvel that I'd waved and walked away quite so casually. Why hadn't I grabbed his arm and begged him one last time to get in the car?
Come on, fuck it, Boris. Just like skipping school. We'll be eating breakfast over cornfields when the sun comes up.
I knew him well enough to know that if you asked him the right way, at the right moment, he would do almost anything. And in the very act of turning away, I knew he would have run after me and hopped in the car laughing if I'd asked one last time. But I didn't. And, in truth, it was maybe better that I didn't. I say that now, though it was something I regretted bitterly for a while. More than anything, I was relieved that in my unfamiliar, babbling and wanting to talk state, I'd stopped myself from blurting the thing on the edge of my tongue. The thing I'd never said, even though it was something we both knew well enough without me saying it out loud to him in the street. Which was, of course, I love you. 20. I was so tired that the drugs didn't last long. At least not the feel-good part. The cab driver, a transplanted New Yorker, from the sound of him, immediately sussed out something was wrong and tried to give me a card for the National Runaway Switchboard, which I refused to take. When I asked him to drive me to the train station, not even knowing if there was a train in Vegas, surely there had to be, he shook his head and said, "You know, don't you, Specs, they don't take dogs on Amtrak."
"They don't?"
I said, my heart sinking. "The plane, maybe. I don't know." He was a youngish guy, a fast talker, baby-faced, slightly overweight, in a t-shirt that said, "Penn and Teller, live at the Rio." "You'll have to have a crate or something." Maybe the bus is your best bet. But they don't let kids under a certain age ride without parental permission.
I told you. My dad died. His girlfriend is sending me to my family back east.
Well, hey, you don't have anything to worry about then, do you?
I kept my mouth shut for the rest of the ride. The fact of my father's death had not yet sunk in, and every now and then, the lights zipping past on the highway brought it back in a sick rush. An accident. At least in New York, we hadn't had to worry about drunk driving. The great fear was that he would fall in front of a car or be stabbed for his wallet, lurching out of some dive bar at 3 a.m. What would happen to his body? I'd scattered my mother's ashes in Central Park, though apparently there was a regulation against it. One evening while it was getting dark, I'd walked with Andy to a deserted area on the west side of the pond and, while Andy kept a lookout, dumped the urn. What had disturbed me far more than the actual scattering of the remains was that the urn had been packed in shredded pieces of porno classifieds, soapy Asian babes and wet-hot orgasms were two random phrases which had caught my eye as the gray powder, the color of moonrock, caught and spun in the May twilight. Then there were lights, and the car stopped.
"Okay, Specs," said my driver, turning with his arm along the back seat.
We were in the parking lot of the Greyhound station.
"What did you say your name was?"
"Theo," I said, without thinking, and immediately was sorry.
"All right, Theo. JP.
He reached across the back seat to shake my hand.
"You want to take my advice about something?"
"Sure," I said, quailing a bit. Even with everything else that was going on, and there was quite a lot, I felt incredibly uncomfortable that this guy had probably seen Boris kissing me in the street.
"None of my business, but you're going to need something to put Fluffy there in."
"Sorry?" He nodded at my bag.
"Will he fit in that?"
You're probably going to have to check that bag anyway. It might be too big for you to carry aboard. They'll stow it underneath. It's not like the plane." This was too much to think about.
"I don't have anything."
"Hang on. Let me check in my office back here." He got up, went around to the trunk, and returned with a large canvas shopping bag from a health food store that said, "The Greening of America." "If I were you," he said, "I'd go in and buy the ticket without Fluffy Boy. Leave him out here with me just in case, okay?" My new pal had been right about not riding Greyhound without an unprotected child form signed by a parent, and there were other restrictions for kids as well. The clerk at the window, a wan Chicana with scraped back hair, began in a monotone to go down the long, baleful list of them. No transfers, no journeys of longer than 5 hours in duration, unless the person named on the unaccompanied child form showed up to meet me with positive identification. I would be released into the custody of Child Protective Services or to local law enforcement officials in the city of my destination.
"But all children under 15, no exceptions."
"But I'm not under 15, I said, floundering to produce my official-looking state-issued New York ID.
"I am 15. Look."
Enrique, envisioning perhaps the likelihood of my having to go into what he called the system, had taken me downtown to be photographed for it shortly after my mother died. And though I'd resented it at the time, Big Brother's far-reaching claw.
"Wow, your very own barcode,"
Andy had said, looking at it curiously. Now I was thankful he'd had the foresight to take me downtown and register me like a second-hand motor vehicle. Numbly, like a refugee, I waited under the sleazy fluorescence as the clerk looked at the card at a number of different angles and in different lights, at length finding it genuine.
15,
she said suspiciously, handing it back to me.
Right.
I knew I didn't look my age. There was, I realized, no question of being upfront about Popper since a big sign by the desk said in red letters, "No dogs, cats, birds, rodents, reptiles, or other animals will be transported." As for the bus itself, I was in luck. There was a 1:45 a.m. with connections to New York, departing the station in 15 minutes. As the machine spat out my ticket with a mechanical smack, I stood in a daze wondering what the hell to do about Popper. Walking outside, I was half hoping my cab driver had driven off, perhaps having whisked Popper away to some more loving and secure home. But instead I found him drinking a can of Red Bull and talking on his cell phone, Popper nowhere in sight. He got off his call when he saw me standing there.
What do you think?
Where is he? Groggily, I looked in the back seat.
What'd you do with him?
He laughed.
Now you don't, and now you do.
With a flourish, he removed the messily folded copy of USA Today from the canvas bag on the front seat beside him. And there, settled contentedly in a cardboard box at the bottom of the bag, crunching on some potato chips, was Popper.
Misdirection, he said. The box fills out the bag so it doesn't look dog-shaped and gives him a little more room to move around. And the newspaper? Perfect prop. Covers him up, makes the bag look full, doesn't add any weight.
Do you think it'll be all right?
Well, I mean, he's such a little guy. What, 5 pounds, 6? Is he quiet?
I looked at him doubtfully, curled at the bottom of the box. Not always. JP wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and gave me the package of potato chips.
Give him a couple of these suckers if he gets antsy. You'll be stopping every few hours. Just sit as far in the back of the bus as you can, and make sure you take him away from the station a ways before you let him out to do his business.
I put the bag over my shoulder and tucked my arm around it.
Can you tell? I asked him.
No, not if I didn't know. But can I give you a tip?
Magician's secret?
Sure.
Don't keep looking down at the bag like that. Anywhere but the bag. The scenery, your shoelace. Okay, there we go, that's right. Confident and natural, that's the kitty. Although klutzy and looking for a dropped contact lens will work too, if you think people are giving you the fisheye. Spill your chips, stub your toe, cough on your drink, anything.
Wow, I thought. Clearly they didn't call it lucky cab for nothing. Again, he laughed, as if I'd spoken the thought aloud.
Hey, it's a stupid rule. No dogs on the bus, he said, taking another big slug of the Red Bull. I mean, what are you supposed to do? Dump them by the side of the road?
Are you a magician or something?
He laughed. How'd you guess? I got a gig doing card tricks in a bar over at the Orleans. If you were old enough to get in, I'd tell you to come down and check out my act sometime. Anyway, the secret is, always fix their attention away from where the slippery stuff's going on. That's the first law of magic, Specs. Misdirection. Never forget it.
21. Utah. The San Rafael swell, as the sun came up, unrolled in inhuman vistas like Mars. Sandstone and shale, gorges, and desolate rust-red mesas. I'd had a hard time sleeping, partly because of the drugs, partly for fear that Popper might fidget or whine, but he was perfectly quiet as we drove the twisted mountain roads, sitting quietly inside his bag on the seat beside me, on the side closest to the window. As it happened, my suitcase had been small enough to bring aboard, which I was happy about for any number of reasons. My sweater, wind, sand, and stars, but most of all my painting, which felt like an article of protection, even wrapped up and out of view, like a holy icon carried by a crusader into battle. There were no other passengers in the back except a shy-looking Hispanic couple with a bunch of plastic food containers on their laps and an old drunk talking to himself, and we made it fine through the winding roads all the way through Utah and into Grand Junction, Colorado, where we had a 50-minute rest stop. After locking my suitcase in a coin-op locker, I walked Popper out behind the bus station, well out of the driver's sight, bought us a couple of hamburgers from Burger King, and gave him water from the plastic top of an old carry-out container I found in the trash. From Grand Junction, I slept, until our layover in Denver, an hour and 16 minutes, just as the sun was going down, where Popper and I ran and ran for sheer relief of being off the bus, ran so far down shadowy, unknown streets that I was almost afraid of getting lost, although I was pleased to find a hippie coffee shop where the clerks were young and friendly.
"Bring him in," said the purple-haired girl at the counter when she saw Popper tied out front. "We love dogs."
And where I bought not only two turkey sandwiches,
one for me, one for him, but a vegan brownie and a greasy paper bag of homemade vegetarian dog biscuits. I read late, creamy paper yellowed in a circle of weak lights, as the unknown darkness sped past, over the Continental Divide and out of the Rockies, Popper content after his romp around Denver and snoozing happily in his bag. At some point, I slept, then woke and read some more. At 2 a.m., just as Saint-Exupéry was telling the story of his plane crash in the desert, we came into Salina, Kansas, crossroads of America. 20-minute rest stop, under a moth-beaten sodium lamp, where Popper and I ran around a deserted gas station parking lot in the dark, my head still full of the book while also exulting in the strangeness of being in my mother's state for the first time in my life. Had she, on her rounds with her father, ever driven through this town? Cars rushing past on the 9th Street interstate exit? Lighted grain silos like starships looming in the emptiness for miles away? Back on the bus, sleepy, dirty, tired out, cold, Popchick and I slept from Salina to Topeka, and from Topeka to Kansas City, Missouri, where we pulled in just at sunrise. My mother had often told me how flat it was where she'd grown up. So flat you could see cyclones spinning across the prairies for miles. But still I couldn't quite believe the vastness of it, the unrelieved sky, so huge that you felt crushed and oppressed by the infinite. In St. Louis, around noon, we had an hour and a half layover, plenty of time for Popper's walk and an awful roast beef sandwich for lunch, although the neighborhood was too dicey to venture far, and, back at the station, a transfer to an entirely different bus. Then, only an hour or two along, I woke, with the bus stopped, to find Popper sitting quietly with the tip of his nose poking out of the bag, and a middle-aged black lady with bright pink lipstick standing over me, thundering, "You can't have that dog on the bus." I stared at her, disoriented. Then, much to my horror, I realized she was no random passenger, but the driver herself, in cap and uniform. "Do you hear what I said?" she repeated with an aggressive side-to-side head tick. She was as wide as a prize fighter. The name tag atop her impressive bosom read Denise. "You can't have that dog on this bus." Then, impatiently, she made a flapping hand gesture as if to say, "Get him the hell back in that bag." I covered his head up. He didn't seem to mind, and sat with rapidly shrinking insides. We were stopped at a town called Effingham, Illinois. Edward Hopper Houses, stage-set courthouse, a hand-lettered banner that said, "Crossroads of Opportunity." The driver swept her finger around. "Do any of you people back here have objections to this animal?" The other passengers in back, unkempt handlebar mustache guy, grown woman with braces, anxious black mom with elementary school girl, W.C. Fields looking oldster with nose tubes and oxygen canister, all looked too surprised to talk, though the little girl, eyes round, shook her head almost imperceptibly. "No." The driver waited. She looked around. Then she turned back to me. "Okay. That's good news for you and the pooch, honey. But if any," she wagged her finger at me, "if any of these other passengers back here complains about you having an animal on board, at any point, I'm going to have to make you get off. Understand?" She wasn't throwing me off? I blinked at her, afraid to move or speak a word. "You understand?" she repeated, more ominously. "Thank you." A bit belligerently, she shook her head. "Oh, no. Don't thank me, honey, because I am putting you off this bus if there is one single complaint. One." I sat in a tremble as she strode down the aisle and started up the bus. As we swung out of the parking lot, I was afraid to even glance at the other passengers, though I could feel them all looking at me. By my knee, Popper let out a tiny huff and resettled. As much as I liked Popper and felt sorry for him, I'd never thought that as dogs went, he was particularly interesting or intelligent.
Instead, I'd spent a lot of time wishing he was a cooler dog, a border collie or a lab or a rescue maybe, some smart and haunted pit mix from the shelter, a scrappy little mutt that chased balls and bit people. In fact, almost anything but what he actually was. A girl's dog, a toy, completely gay. A dog I felt embarrassed to walk on the street. Not that Popper wasn't cute. In fact, he was exactly the kind of tiny, prancing fluffball that a lot of people liked. Maybe not me, but surely some little girl like the one across the aisle would find him by the road and take him home and tie ribbons in his hair. Rigidly, I sat there, reliving the bolt of fear again and again. The driver's approach. My shock. What really scared me was that I now knew if she made me put Popper off the bus, that I would have to get off with him too. And do what? Even in the middle of Illinois nowhere. Rain, cornfields, standing by the side of the road. How had I become attached to such a ridiculous animal? A lapdog that Zandra had chosen. Throughout Illinois and Indiana, I sat swaying and vigilant, too afraid to go to sleep. The trees were bare, rotted out Halloween pumpkins on the porches. Across the aisle, the mother had her arm around the little girl and was singing, very quietly, "You Are My Sunshine." I had nothing to eat but leftover crumbs of the potato chips the cab driver had given me, and ugly salt taste in my mouth, industrial plains, little nowhere towns rolling past. I felt chilled and forlorn, looking out at the bleak farmland and thinking of songs my mother had sung to me way back when. "Toot toot tootsie goodbye. Toot toot tootsie don't cry." At last, in Ohio, when it was dark and the lights in the sad little far apart houses were coming on, I felt safe enough to drowse off, nodding back and forth in my sleep, until Cleveland, cold, white-lit city where I changed buses at 2 in the morning. I was afraid to give Popper the long walk I knew he needed, for fear that someone might see us, because what would we do if we were found out? Stay in Cleveland forever? But he seemed frightened too, and we stood shivering on a street corner for 10 minutes before I gave him some water, put him in the bag, and walked back to the station to board. It was the middle of the night, and everyone seemed half asleep, which made the transfer easier. And we transferred again at noon the next day in Buffalo, where the bus crunched out through piled-up sleet in the station. The wind was biting with a sharp, wet edge. After 2 years in the desert, I'd forgotten what real winter, aching and raw, was like. Boris had not returned any of my texts, which was perhaps understandable since I was sending them to Kotku's phone. But I sent another one anyway. "Buffalo, New York. NYC tonight. Hope you are okay. Have you heard from X?" Buffalo is a long way from New York City, but apart from a dreamlike, feverish stop in Syracuse, where I walked and watered Popper and bought us a couple of cheese Danishes because there wasn't anything else, I managed to sleep almost the whole way, through Batavia and Rochester and Syracuse and Binghamton, with my cheek against the window and cold air coming through at the crack, the vibration taking me back to wind, sand, and stars, and a lonely cockpit high above the desert. I think I must have been getting quietly sick ever since the stop in Cleveland, but by the time I finally got off the bus, in Port Authority, it was evening, and I was burning up with fever. I was chilled, wobbly on my legs, and the city, which I'd longed for so fiercely, seemed foreign and noisy and cold, exhaust fumes and garbage and strangers rushing past in every direction. The terminal was packed with cops. Everywhere I looked, there were signs for runaway shelters, runaway hotlines, and one lady cop in particular gave me the fisheye as I was hurrying outside. After 60-plus hours on the bus, I was dirty and tired and knew I didn't really pass muster. But nobody stopped me, and I didn't look behind me until I was out on the street, and well away. Several men of varying age and nationality called out to me on the street, soft voices coming from several directions. "Hey, little brother, where you headed? Need a ride?" But though one red-headed guy in particular seemed nice and normal and not much older than me, almost like someone I might be friends with,
I was enough of a New Yorker to ignore his cheerful hello and keep walking like I knew where I was going. I'd thought Popper would be overjoyed to get out and walk, but when I put him down on the sidewalk, 8th Avenue was too much for him, and he was too scared to go more than a block or so. He'd never been on a city street before. Everything terrified him. Cars, car horns, people's legs, empty plastic bags blowing down the sidewalk. And he kept jerking forward, darting toward the crosswalk, jumping this way and that, dashing behind me in terror, and winding the leash around my legs so I tripped and nearly fell in front of a van rushing to beat the light. After I picked him up, paddling, and stuck him back in his bag, where he scrabbled and huffed in exasperation before he got quiet, I stood in the middle of the rush hour crowd, trying to get my bearings. Everything seemed so much dirtier and unfriendlier than I remembered. Colder, too. Streets gray like old newspaper. Que faire, as my mother had liked to say. I could almost hear her saying it, in her light, careless voice. I'd often wondered, when my father prowled around banging the kitchen cabinets and complaining that he wanted a drink, what wanting a drink felt like. What it felt like to want alcohol and nothing but, not water or Pepsi or anything else. Now, I thought bleakly, I know. I was dying for a beer, but I knew better than to go in a deli and try to buy one without ID. Longingly, I thought of Mr. Pavlikovsky's vodka, the daily blast of warmth I'd come to take for granted. More to the point, I was starving. I was a few doors down from a fancy cupcake place, and I was so hungry I turned right in and bought the first one that caught my eye. Green tea flavored, as it turned out, with some kind of vanilla filling. Weird, but still delicious. Almost at once, the sugar made me feel better. And while I ate, licking the custard off my fingers, I stared in amazement at the purposeful mob. Leaving Vegas, I'd somehow felt a lot more confident about how all this would play out. Would Mrs. Barber phone social services to tell them I'd turned up? I'd thought not, but now I wondered. There was also the not-so-insignificant question of Popper, since, along with dairy and tree nuts and adhesive tape and sandwich mustard and about 25 other commonly found household items, Andy was violently allergic to dogs. Not just dogs, but also cats and horses and circus animals and the class guinea pig, Pig Newton, that we'd had way back in second grade, which was why there were no pets at the barber's house. Somehow this had not seemed such an insurmountable problem back in Vegas. But standing out on 8th Avenue when it was cold and getting dark, it did. Not knowing what else to do, I started walking east toward Park Avenue. The wind hit raw in my face, and the smell of rain in the air made me nervous. The skies in New York seemed a lot lower and heavier than out west. Dirty clouds, eraser smudged, like pencil on rough paper. It was as if the desert, its openness, had retrained my distance vision. Everything seemed dank and closed in. Walking helped me work out the roll in my legs. I walked east to the library. The lions! I stood still for a moment, like a returning soldier catching my first glimpse of home. And then I turned up 5th Avenue. Street lamps on, still fairly busy, though it was emptying out for the night. Up to Central Park South. As tired as I was and cold, still my heart stiffened to see the park. And I ran across 57th, Street of Joy, to the leafy darkness. The smells, the shadows, even the dappled pale trunks of the plane trees lifted my spirits, but yet it was as if I was seeing another park beneath the tangible one, a map to the past, a ghost park, dark with memory, school outings and zoo visits of long ago. I was walking along the sidewalk on the 5th Avenue side, looking in, and the paths were tree-shadowed, haloed with street lamps, mysterious and inviting like the woods from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. If I turned and walked down one of those lighted paths, would I walk out again into a different year? Maybe even a different future, where my mother, just out of work, would be waiting for me slightly windblown on the bench, our bench, by the pond, putting her cell phone away,
standing to kiss me.
Hi, puppy. How was school? What do you want to eat for dinner?
Then, suddenly, I stopped. A familiar presence in a business suit had shouldered past and was striding down the sidewalk ahead of me. The shock of white hair stood out in the darkness, white hair that looked as if it ought to be worn long and tied back with a ribbon. He was preoccupied, more rumpled than usual, but still I recognized him immediately. The angle of his head with its faint echo of Andy. Mr. Barber, briefcase and all, on his way home from work. I ran to catch up with him.
Mr. Barber?
I called. He was talking to himself, though I couldn't hear what he was saying.
Mr. Barber, it's Theo,
I said loudly, catching him by the sleeve. With shocking violence, he turned and threw my hand off. It was Mr. Barber, all right. I would have known him anywhere. But his eyes on mine were a stranger's, bright and hard and contemptuous.
No more handouts,
he cried in a high voice.
Get lost!
I ought to have known mania when I saw it. It was an amped-up version of the look my dad had sometimes on game day, or for that matter, when he'd hauled off and hit me. I'd never been around Mr. Barber when he was off his medicine. Andy, typically, had been restrained in describing his father's enthusiasms. I didn't then know about the episodes where he'd try to telephone the Secretary of State or wear his pajamas to work. And his rage was so out of character for the bemused and inattentive Mr. Barber I knew that all I could do was fall back in shame. He glared at me for a long moment and then brushed his arm off as if I was dirty, as if I'd contaminated him by touching him, and then stalked away.
Were you asking that man for money?
Said another man who had sidled up out of nowhere as I stood on the sidewalk, astonished.
Were you?
He said, more insistently, when I turned away. His build was pudgy, his suit blandly corporate and married with kids looking, and his sad sack demeanor gave me the creeps. As I tried to step around him, he stepped in my path and dropped a heavy hand on my shoulder, and in a panic, I dodged around him and ran off into the park. I headed down to the pond, down paths yellow and sodden with fallen leaves, where I went by instinct straight to the rendezvous point, as my mother and I called our bench, and sat shivering. It had seemed the most incredible, unbelievable luck, spotting Mr. Barber on the street. I'd thought, for maybe 5 seconds, that after the first awkwardness and puzzlement, he would greet me happily, ask a few questions. Oh, never mind, never mind, there's time for that later. And walk with me up to the apartment. My goodness, what an adventure. Won't Andy be pleased to see you? Jesus, I thought, running my hand through my hair, still feeling shaken. In an ideal world, Mr. Barber would have been the member of the family I would most have wanted to meet on the street. More than Andy. Certainly more than Andy's siblings. More than even Mrs. Barber, with her frozen pauses, her social niceties and her codes of behavior unknown to me. Her chilling and unreadable gaze. Out of habit, I checked my phone for texts for what seemed like the 10,000th time, and was cheered despite myself to find at long last a message, number I didn't recognize, but it had to be Boris.
Hey, hope you two are okay. Not too mad. Ring Zandra, okay? She has been bugging me.
I tried calling him back. I texted him about 50 times from the road, but no one picked up at that number, and Kotku's phone took me straight to voicemail. Zandra could wait. Walking back to Central Park South with Popper, I bought 3 hot dogs from a vendor who was just shutting up for the day, 1 for Popper, 2 for me. And while we ate, on an out-of-the-way bench inside the Scholar's Gate, considered my options. In my desert fantasias of New York, I'd sometimes entertained perverse images of Boris and me living on the street, around St. Mark's Place or Tompkins Square, quite possibly standing around rattling our change cups with the very skate rats who'd once jeered at Andy and me in our school uniforms. But the real prospect of sleeping on the street was a whole lot less appealing,
alone and feverish in the November cold. The hell of it was, I was only about 5